RadioInfluence.com.
Welcome to the February 26, 2020 edition of the MMA Report Podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Floyd. And coming up here on this week's edition of the show, we'll take a look back at the trio of events we saw last weekend between the UFC and Bellator. We'll have a little follow-up discussion on the Diego Sanchez topic we had last week, as Coach did a couple interviews last week that I think were interesting. I guess that'd be about the best way to put it. Then also we're going to talk about Justin Gaethje and his next fight, talk about the tweet that his manager Ali Abdelaziz sent out on Tuesday. We'll get you ready for Saturday's UFC Norfolk, which of course the vacant flyweight title will be on the line, and then we'll wrap up the show by talking about two notable fight bookings from the UFC. And of course, a great way to show your support for this podcast is leaving a rating on Apple Podcasts. That really does help out myself and Daniel. Daniel, how you doing here on this Wednesday afternoon?
You know, Jason, I'm doing good. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm a little winded because I was wearing a 40-pound costume as I made my entrance to do the podcast. So I may not be myself, but I'm not going to take responsibility for it. I'm going to blame it on everybody else, my corner man, my costume. I'm going to blame it on everyone except for myself.
Yeah, you know, the interesting part of that is, because obviously, one of his corner men threw in the towel. It kind of made me think of the UFC Auckland card and the fact of Carolina Kovacevic's corner didn't throw in the towel for her. And, we see how the injuries that she sustained in that fight, I think it's correlating the two.
Dude, the doctor looked at her eye, and look, I didn't have an up close personal look at her eye, but I'm looking at her eye on her social media post the day after, where she looks like she just went through she looks like she got hit so hard by a train. She looked so sad, so beaten up, and she talked about her eye injury as if like it was an absurdly significant deal that's going to impact her fight career in a big time way. So it's like, damn, I'm not super sure what her eye injury was in particular. I know she mentioned she broke something. I don't know if it was an orbital bone or whatnot. But the moral of the story is the doctor looking at her eye, it's like, damn, like the process probably isn't correct. If the doctor looked at her eye, the damage was that bad and the fight continued after that first round. And she is paying the price for that because it's like the rehabilitation process for Carolina Kovacevic is going to be the hardest fight in her career.
Yeah, the one thing about her is, you think back, it wasn't that long ago that she fought Joanna for the title back in November of 2017. Since then, she's only won two fights, getting wins against Esquivel and Herrig, and now she's dropped four in a row. It'll be interesting to see if the UFC gives her another opportunity. I think if you ask me yes or no, I think the answer is no. I think that, she'll be fighting, somewhere else, later on this year once she does recover from those eye injuries, saying that she's able to return this year. But UFC Auckland, and we talked about it last week on the podcast, it was about that main event. The rest of the card was what the rest of the card was, in terms of tuning in to watch those fights. The reason you were tuning in was for the main event. Daniel, it's a close fight. I think if you have 48-47 Dan Hooker, no argument with you. If you have 48-47 for Paul Felder, no argument for you. And obviously, part of the talking point after the fact was, Paul Felder, what he said, which appeared to be, probably more of an emotional thing, because I think we both know if he would have won that fight, I don't know if he responds the way he does. I expect that we're going to see Paul Felder back in competition at some time, but it was an excellent 155-pound fight.
Oh, dude, it was a great fight. It was definitely a fight that felt worthy of a main event status, even though I wasn't completely sold on it when we got the pre-fight video package and they were able to make a mountain out of a molehill with the pre-fight hype where Hooker was. The beef between these two was that Paul Felder made fun of Dan Hooker's last name and Dan Hooker treated it as though like he had just like pooped on his front lawn. He's like, "You shall not disrespect my surname. I will fight." And all of a sudden, this is a blood feud, apparently. I thought the video package is good. The entrances were great. Paul Felder comes out with a nice little entrance where it's like a remix. I kind of already forgot what the first song was in the remix, but the second song was the Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, which is a song that, like, I feel like the Born in the USA, like, people don't really realize what it's about, but it's still just vibes, and so people still rock it. The fight itself lived up to expectations. It wasn't necessarily like your stereotypical Rock'em Suck'em Robot. This was much more of a tactical striking contest, largely due to Dan Hooker's strategy. I think for Paul Felder, he probably would have preferred that five round balls to the wall type action, because when you look at what happened here, we saw a really nice tactical fight where Dan Hooker utilizes length to do a good job early on in this fight. And it was Paul Felder with like one eye completely shut that towards the end of this fight, he brought things in close and seemed like he was landing the more significant strikes. But anytime you have two top tier 155 pounders striking with one another for 25 consecutive minutes, at the end of it, you're going to have a memorable fight. And that's exactly what happened. This was a fight that really was the fight of the weekend in this sport, in my opinion. And it was a great victory for Dan Hooker. And for Paul Felder, you know, when he announced his retirement again, it was an emotional decision. I think a lot of times in this sport, the retirements that stick are the ones where you decide before the fight, regardless of the result, that you are going to be gone. But for a guy in Paul Felder, who's in his mid-30s, who will continue to commentate along the UFC, I guarantee you he will fight again. Because when you look about what his track record was heading into his fight, both these guys were on an absolute tear. For Hooker, he's won so many fights in a row. I need to find that out. But for Paul Felder, he's won five of his last six. And for Dan Hooker, you're talking about a guy who has won seven of his last eight. So again, a main event between two top tier lightweights. They fought like it, and I guarantee we will see both of them fight relatively soon.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when Paul made that interview, which I was kind of getting ready to go to a buddy's house to watch the Wilder Fury fight, and when he initially started kind of talking about, you know, retirement, and I think, you know, anyone can understand, you know, when the fact that he has to, you know, go away for training camps, away from his daughter, you know, who lives in the Philadelphia area, you understand where he's coming from. And the fact of, you know, Paul is, you know, the less than 1% of UFC fighters that has been granted the ability to commentate on fights and make money that way. Obviously nowhere near the type of money he's going to make fighting, but he's going to put himself in a good situation. You know, Dan Hooker talked about, you know, Justin Gaethje and Dustin Poirier, and we'll talk about Gaethje in a little bit. I mean, both those fights make sense. I mean, for Paul Felder, I mean, yeah, it's a roadblock. There's no question about it, but, you know, he can get right back into title contention, you know, and probably, you know, now it's going to take, you know, probably 2 to 3 fights as opposed to maybe one more fight. But that was, you know, to me, that was the biggest thing about UFC Aucklin, you know, that really, you know, sticks out to me. I wouldn't say there was a ton of shocking results on the card. I guess, you know, maybe, you know, Priscilla getting that win against Shane Dobson. I mean, Shane Dobson was a pretty big, you know, favorite in that one. And Priscilla Cachoeira just had not, you know, done anything well. I mean, I'm pretty sure it was probably her last violent deal since it was her fourth UFC fight. Angela Hill, who's just this crazy schedule that she's been on over the past year, you know, I think it was 6 fights now in the last 11 months. I believe the average time between fights that she's had is 56 days, which is just a crazy number. But overall, I think it was kind of a card that, you know, kind of, you know, for the most part went the way you expected.
Yeah, I think so too, man. This card really was entertaining. I'll give it that much. There were a lot of things that happened on this card. You know, some of the things you already mentioned. I mean, to me, Angela Hill has really picked up a lot of steam. And it's a lot to do with things that, like, being on the Joe Rogan podcast, her fight activity. I think this, you know, these 6 fights within a year span is something that she's done it in a shorter amount of time than pretty much anyone, not including tournament UFC fights. I read an article on The Athletic where they kind of went through, and no surprise that Donald Cerrone was on that list. But I believe Angela Hill's period in which she got all these fights in was the shortest for non-tournament fights. So yeah, Angela Hill looked good against Luke Boonmi. In terms of the other performances, I mean, again, I think for first and foremost, the number one takeaway for me, when you're not looking at the main event, would be Yan Zhenan is going to challenge for the Women's Strawweight Championship at some point. When you look at her performance against Katarzyna Kovalevich, every time she gets a test, she has looked really good lately. And when I look at her stand-up and her approach to the game, I just think that she is on a great trajectory. And she's the one fighter who impressed me the most. But in terms of other fighters, I think you got to look at the featherweight division. Zubair Tukhugov basically put Kevin Aguilar away in that first round with some hard shots. And this was a fight that definitely could have gone the distance. But Tukhugov took care of him. In addition to that, Jake Matthews looked really good in rounds one and two against Emil Meek. And it was round three. Did go to Meek. But Jake Matthews, to me, looked good at welterweight. Also at welterweight, Song Ki-nan looked awesome and got the first round finish, putting away Callan Porter. And then just a couple other notes. Marcos Rogério de Lima took out the, you know, the Roy Nelson lookalike Ben Sosely in the first round with strikes. And then Jimmy Crute, I mean, just an easy submission victory in the first round for him in the light heavyweight division. So those are the fighters that stuck out to me in terms of like, damn, that was a good performance.
You know what my biggest takeaway from Friday night with Bellator 239 was?
What's that?
That the Chickasaw Nation has the better ability to hire quality judges than the Texas Commission does.
Yeah, we had a lot of close decisions, didn't we? And it didn't seem like, yeah, you know, we didn't see anything outrageous.
It was all notable judges scoring fights. Now, one fight in the prelims you can look at and say, hey, that's kind of a questionable scorecard. But over, you know, that was like, you just as I was watching the fights on Friday night, and, you know, you start hearing the judges' names, and I even tweeted about it. I'm like, yeah, biggest takeaway is the fact that the Chickasaw Nation can hire better judges than the Texas Commission has, which obviously that's, you know, still an ongoing type of discussion there. But obviously, you know, Bellator 239, it was, you know, even though Ed Ruth was the betting underdog, I think a lot of people still kind of, you know, thought and Amosov, what he was able to do just, you know, with his wrestling abilities and kind of dictating, you know, where the fight went, you know, solid performance by him. But, you know, really the other takeaways from that card really is about some prospects losing, most notably Tyrell Fortune getting upset by Tim Johnson, getting knocked out. Was listening to Weighing In, which is Josh Thompson and John McCarthy's podcast. And of course, McCarthy was calling the fights in Thackerville. And he mentioned that the fact of, you know, Tyrell Fortune actually injured his knee the day before the fights, and saying that his coaches said that, you know, they had to alter the game plan. And, you know, and so it's unfortunate that happened. And, you know, Tyrell Fortune, you know, this is a guy that I think you could have made the case that, you know, potentially, you know, would be, you know, fighting for a title in the very near future, you know, with a win there. I mean, and you know, Sean Bunch, who obviously, you know, Sean's, you know, in, you know, in his older 30s, I think I want to say Sean's 36 years old. You know, Keith Lee, who has been, you know, unfortunately for him, he's been on the wrong side of split decisions. He goes out there and wins a very clear decision. Varga, the kickboxing champion, he loses, and where Britton, all he did in that fight was he was able to, you know, use him in the clinch and didn't allow that fight to go at range. But to me, I think the two big takeaways have to be Amosov and clearly putting himself, I think when you talk about that top five, you know, in the Bellator 170-pound division, he puts himself right up there, and Tyrell Fortune being upset.
Yeah, to me, it's all about that main event, man. Amosov, Ed Ruth, and Ed Ruth should not be that disheartened because this was a close fight, man. This was a war, a wrestling versus Sambo war we saw take place in the cage. It was back and forth, and it was Amosov's night. I think for him, really, things were clearly in his favor moving into round two. And what he did so well, I thought, was in addition to the wrestling battle, it was the stand-up of his that I thought was superior to Ed Roos. And it was the, it almost felt like just a war of attrition that cliche, I think, really rings true in this main event, and as to why Yaroslav Amosov won. But this was a really compelling wrestling contest between these two guys. And I think Ed Ruth is absolutely going to return to form in this welterweight division. But it is Amosov's time, and he's just really put it together in this Bellator welterweight division. So, yeah, I think for him, he's someone who, you look at whoever gets that welterweight championship, they're going to have a date with Yaroslav Amosov, and I don't think he's going to pay the tab. I think the Tyra Fortune result is definitely the number two takeaway, Jason. I don't know how it can't be, because this is a guy who was set up to win here. Timothy Johnson has not performed well in his last few Bellator outings. He has been put away, and you feel great for him, because you got to think it's got to be so rough to be in those shoes, to be in Timothy Johnson's shoes, to be in the UFC and find yourself now being used as a stepping stone for the prospects. Loss after loss after loss, and not just losses, but knockout losses. So you feel so good for Timothy Johnson to go into that Bellator cage against a guy people were expecting to run through him, and he gets that knockout victory. You know, Fortune was caught against the cage, man. He was not moving well at that point. There was not a whole lot of space for him to evade strikes, and that caused him to get down the canvas. When we see prospects lose like this, I would not write him off. He still has a great skill base. I think once he gets right, once he puts some time back in the camp and he knows he's fighting, he will take some lessons from this performance and do well in a heavyweight division that is very forgiving for those that maybe struggle early on. Like when you look at the rest of the card, Jury Gertz was a really close fight, and different judges definitely could have given that fight to Brandon Gertz, but it was the counter approach of Miles Jury that got him his first Bellator win. And Valentin Moldavsky just destroyed my boy Javi Ayala, man. Just an unpleasant experience for Javi Ayala. He was put on the canvas time and again. And when you read these scorecards, by God, 30-25, 30-24, 30-24. Not a good night for Ayala, where he was used as the stepping stone for Valentin Moldavsky.
Yeah, you know, I want to go back to Amosov, and you're right. I mean, Ayala just got, I mean, that was just a very one-sided fight. It's going to be kind of interesting to see how Rich Chow kind of works out the top of this welterweight division, because obviously we've got the champion Douglas Lima fighting for the 185-pound title, and then you've got a collection of names. You know, you look at Lorenz Larkin, you look at Michael Page, you know, Neiman Gracie, Andre Koreshkov. You know, so there's all these guys. So I'm really interested to kind of see how they play this division out. I would expect that Michael Page's next fight will be on May the 16th in London. You know, that's when they're going to head there. Of course, James Gallagher is going to be on that card. I do want to talk about Gallagher here in a little bit, but to me, it's just been kind of fascinating to see how they play this 170-pound division out while Douglas Lima is preparing for a middleweight title fight.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I think when you look at the cream that's going to rise to the top, I think it's Amosov. I really do. Like, I am all aboard his hype train. And I think when you look at those welterweight contenders, I think it's the fact that I believe he has the ability to win this fight with his sambo against all these guys. Mm-hmm. Is kind of how I think it's going to play out.
The one fight that, and I don't think Bellator would book this fight, but mm-hmm. is how would he fare against Michael Page?
I think he would do well, because I think he has a no-nonsense approach to this fight game. And I just think he's not going to play into that stand-up show that Page does. I think he's going to just close that distance and bring him down. You know, I don't think he's going to fall in love with his hands against Michael Page. I think when you look at his approach to the game, I think what separates Amosov apart from a lot of fighters is he has a game plan. And I tell you what, this extends to not only Amosov, but a lot of international fighters we see from like those backgrounds, is like, it's just a no nonsense approach to, they don't get in their own head with their game plans. It's just, this is my game plan, I'm going to enact it, and this force of will cause me to win. And that's why I think that's going to just do so well against a guy like Michael Page, where you match him up against Michael Page, he's going to just wrestle the hell out of him. But that fight is not happening anytime soon, I don't think, because it just is a Bellator is in the Michael Page business, is what I will say. Mm-hmm. They are in the business to make him look good and put him in big-time fights, and Amosov is a wet blanket for any potential welterweight star you're trying to make.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, just kind of see his wrestling and what he was able to do. And then, of course, on Saturday, Bellator was in Dublin. You may or may not have seen the story that I had up on theamireport.com. Kiefer Crosby was fined $2,500 for unsportsmanlike conduct by the Mohegan Tribe Department of Athletic Regulations. Of course, they are the regulatory body who regulates all of Bellator's overseas events, as Bellator does not want to be a promotion that self-regulates events. And of course, Mike Mazzulli, the head of the Mohegan Tribe Department of Athletic Regulations, told me about this and cited that the fine was for unsportsmanlike conduct for people who did see the fight in the last minute of the fight. Kiefer is trying to get his opponent to come to the ground with him, and he gives him the middle finger salute on two occasions while on the ground. And what Mike told me is that during his rules meeting with the fighters on Friday morning in Dublin, that he said that inappropriate gestures are considered abusive language and not suitable in the cage. And he noted Rule 21 of the current Unified Rules of MMA, which state this: use of abusive language in the fighting area. The use of abusive language is not allowed during MMA competition. It's the sole responsibility of the referee to determine when language crosses over the line to abusive. It should be clear that fighters can talk during a match. The mere use of auditory language is not a violation of this rule. Examples of abusive language would be racially motivated or derogatory language. Now, initially, this was a $5,000 fine. Crosby did apologize to the commission, and the fine was reduced to $2,500. This was something that was said on multiple occasions in the rules meeting, so the fighters were very aware of it. And you know, and look, I understand that there's a lot of people who are not going to be on board with a commission doing that, and I completely understand that. But I think the other side of it is you know, look, the commission has these rules, and you got to obey by these rules. And so, you know, it's unfortunate for Kiefer Crosby to lose $2,500, but ultimately, you know, the double middle finger salute ultimately cost him, you know, $2,500. But you know, to me, I mean, obviously Brent Primus, another win for him. Ricky Bandejas, another win for him. Obviously, you know, when you talk about Brent Primus, Daniel, it's this lightweight division. And I'm hoping to talk to Brent Primus later on this week. I know he hasn't quite made his way back over to the United States yet. He'll be back here late in the week. And I'm just, you know, I think with him, it's you know, being more active, not having just one fight a year. I think that's going to be the key with him. And of course, you know, the lightweight division is, you know, the title is essentially, you know, vacant. I shouldn't say vacant, Daniel. I mean, it's a belt that's not going to be defended till probably April 2021.
Yeah. Well, maybe if Brent Primus will probably piece together like 47 wins before that point, because if they continue to match him up with late replacement guys like Chris Bungard, I think he can fight every month. I really do, because Brent Primus is just a highly skilled lightweight who's going to run through these guys like he did at Bellator 240, man. And it's a long, long wait, but you look at this roster of guys who aren't there, I think Brett Primus is going to set himself apart when it's time to challenge for the title by this point, man. I mean, he just continues to improve, and I think for him, it's just going to be a frustrating approach. But I just, again, I don't think there's that many people out there Bellator can match him up with where it's going to be that compelling, because he's clearly in a different category than these guys. And I know a big reason is late replacement fights. You know, I know originally he was supposed to fight Peter Queeley, but even in that aspect, it's like, that's not a fight for Primus's caliber. So, yeah, I mean, Brett Primus was to me the big story, Bellator 240. I mean, you mentioned the Kiefer Crosby thing, $2,500, and you mentioned in your article that it was originally $5,000, but he apologized and it got brought down to $2,500. That's a big chunk of money for Kiefer Crosby. I'm not super sure what his pay was, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was not that much. Do we have an idea what his fighter pay was?
No idea. The Mohegan Tribe doesn't release fighter pay. I mean, I would imagine since this was in Ireland that I'm sure he got maybe commission on tickets that he sold. So whatever that, that's something that every fighter negotiates. I mean, I've heard some crazy numbers get thrown out there. Not just on the regional MMA scene, not talking Bellator, but yeah, just where a fighter knows that they're a really good ticket seller. They negotiate a very high percentage of commission. So, if you're a massive ticket seller, you can do very well, but I have no idea what Kiefer made. I mean, but yeah, I mean, obviously losing $2,500, I'm sure that was a nice chunk of what he made.
Yeah. And it's just, man.
Here's the other thing. By doing that, to me, that sends a message to every fighter that's on that Bellator European Series.
Oh, yeah. That certainly does. And I don't know. I just can't jive with that, to be honest with you, at all, actually.
I get it. I understand it. I get why, people look at that. But I think that, to me, it's... you just kind of it makes you wonder, maybe is this just been something that's been brewing for some time? And the commission just said, you know what, if we're going to have these rules and we're going to tell you can't do it, at some point we got to enforce it.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I just think they should eliminate the rules. I don't think this sport lends itself to be. I think this sport is about entertainment in a big way.
When I learned about this, I went back and watched the fight. I thought it was an entertaining fight. I didn't think that Kiefer needed to do that. It's one of those things of when you see a fighter go down there and it's such the whole waving down. Come on, come to the ground with me. No, dog. I'm good. Mm-hmm. No, you can come back in my world. It was a good fight. It was a close fight. But it's just one of those things that I just look at and say. I see both sides of the story.
Yeah, I certainly see both sides of the story. I just am always apprehensive to commissions finding fighters and in a field where the non-stars are scraping by, even though maybe they make a pretty chunk on those per ticket sales, I'm always kind of like, when you're taking money away, it's a bit of a downer, but certainly you are right in that a message is being sent. If you're on that Bellator European Series, you're like, okay, I'm not going to do that. What was interesting to me, what stuck out to me, something I wasn't really aware of until I was looking at the MA decisions, was that Dan Mercoliata was a judge for the first two bouts in the prelims and then would go on to referee. I thought that was interesting.
That happened. I mean, on regional MMA, that happens a lot. I mean, that happens, absolutely a lot of the times. I mean, look, it's unfortunate for Kiefer Crosby, but I mean, look, it is what it is. Move on. It's like when I hear camps and fighters complain about, oh, the commission won't let me, stand on top of the cage and jump off or things along those lines. And I always, my response to them is always this: go have a private conversation with the head management of Bellator. Just see how much maybe that Darren Caldwell lawsuit cost them.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
There's a reason Bellator doesn't want guys doing that. There is a very good reason.
Exactly, man. I mean, those lawsuits are expensive, and it just takes one event to take a lot of money out of a promotion.
Oh, exactly. And you know how much those cameras weigh, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're expensive, and they weigh a whole hell of a lot, especially those big ones that they use for Bellator. It just takes one bad situation out of doing it 100 times to absolutely set the tone for we are not letting this happen again. So I understand the cage deal.
Now, of course, James Gallagher was supposed to headline this card. Back injury forced him out of it. And I was watching his interview with Ariel Helwani on Monday. And, he's and obviously the Ricky line comes up, which I'm in this defense of, like, why does Ricky need to fight you again? It was pretty clear that, it happened the first time. And, and look, James has won three in a row. I think he's been put in favorable matchups. He mentioned about he wants to get this win against Cal Eleanor in May. And then he wants Sergio Pettis. And look, first off, I don't think Sergio Pettis is going to sit around and wait for you. And sometimes when I listen to James Gallagher talk, I think that, and rightfully so, he gets defensive kind of, I think, with a lot of people calling him out. But, I mean, look, I can tell you, I've talked to managers about this. There is there is a crap ton of fighters who want to fight James Gallagher because they believe he's not at their level.
Oh, yeah. It's the old Michael Bisping deal. I mean, obviously, Michael Bisping was a much more heralded fighter at the time, but Michael Bisping at the time was seen as a top-tier middleweight who was a lot easier to beat than the other top-tier middleweights. And here's the kicker. People care about him. So if you beat Michael Bisping, that matters. If you beat James Gallagher, especially in his home country in Ireland, that matters. It's like there are so many fighters who we believe are more talented than James Gallagher, but will provide you with less upward momentum than had you beat him. It's as simple as that. And it's a good place to be if you're a fighter like that, if you are James Gallagher, though, because that tells you you are the business. You are a business fighter. You are a fighter who's good for business, who the promotion is going to build cards around. And that's kind of been why, you know, the strategy for Bellator on this European series has been like, all right, let's book a James Gallagher fight. And yeah, for Ricky Bendejas, I mean, he looks phenomenal. I mean, the Georgie Karakhanian stuck up on me on that card too, mm-hmm. when he getting that win over Paul Redmond. I didn't even see that fight.
And now at 55.
At 155 pounds. Wow, because he's a small guy in my opinion. Watching him fight at featherweight. He just doesn't come... He never came across as a guy watching him fight at 145 where I'm like, all right, he needs to move up because, like, dude, some of these 155-pounders have such long frames. So it's good for him. And, you know, good for Beck Rollins, too. You feel good for her because she hasn't had a whole lot of victories. She really hasn't. No. And she was able to get one over Alina Kalianito, who I'm sure I butchered her name. I apologize.
And I like her call out of Heather Hardy.
It's a great, smart call out.
Because, it's a call out that if you're, you know, Scott Coker or Rich Chow, you're going, you know what? Yeah, we like that fight. Because you pretty much look at it and say, you don't expect that Beck's going to magically just turn into a wrestler. That she's going to sit there and have a striking match with Heather Hardy. And that if you're booking Heather Hardy in a fight, that's the type of opponent that you want her to go up against.
Mm-hmm. Yep. She is, man, and it's a great matchup. You got the 2-2 Heather Hardy versus Beck Rollins, and I think that makes a lot of sense for both parties because Heather Hardy isn't taking this sport by storm, but if she's someone who you want to still build around, if you're Bellator, this is a great fight for her. So I'm down for Hardy and Rollins. You know, we have it here. We can have it Bare Knuckle FC. That would be a scary matchup for Beck Rollins if they fought bare knuckle boxing. But in the MMA cage, I think that makes a lot of sense for Bellator to go with that. But we have not seen Heather Hardy since like June 2019. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting fight to make. Of course, Bellator's next event will be on March 13th. Of course, that's going to be the continuation of the Featherweight World Grand Prix. You got two Featherweight Grand Prix fights on that fight card, of course, headlined by Patricio Pitbull going up against Pedro Carvalho, not Rafael Carvalho, much, much bigger guy there. So that's March 13th. I'll tell you, Bellator's got a nice little preliminary card that they've been putting together for that one. Of course, the next UFC fight card is coming up on Saturday, UFC Norfolk. We'll talk about that here in just a moment. But, you know, Daniel, last week on the show, we were talking about the business decision that Diego Sanchez made at UFC Rio Rancho. And, you know, we both understood exactly what he did. And, we saw Anthony Smith a while ago say he didn't make the business decision, which would have been very good for him against John Jones. But, of course, Diego did. And, of course, his coach, manager, nutritionist. Am I leaving anything else out?
A bullshit artist. That's it. I'm so tired. I'm so tired of this dude. I'm so tired. I read the interview you did with The Athletic. I've listened to some of the sound bites. Stop it. I'm done with this. I'm done with this dude. This dude's ridiculous. This dude's ridiculous. He plays the victim card like he's some genius. Dude, you're going around with a knife trying to scare Emil Meek. Like, really? You're trying to push people with the finger? Nah, bro. Josh Fabi is a clown, and he took advantage of a guy in Diego Sanchez who was, like, able to be manipulated. There's a reason why the only guy in his corner is Diego Sanchez and not half the UFC roster, because if he actually did half the things he preached, hell, if he did a tenth of the things he preached, he'd have half the damn UFC roster training under him. He just has one dude
who can be manipulated.
Yeah.
God bless Josh Gross for transcribing that thing.
I know. He asked him one question, and Fabio would go on for forever. And it's a bunch of malarkey.
I was listening to Gross's podcast. It's unfortunate that he announced his podcast is going away. Him and Fernando Prada's podcast going away from The Athletic. And he said on his podcast, he was talking about that interview. He said that was an hour-long interview. And he said, he goes, I may have talked 5 minutes.
Exactly. And like, Fabio is so defensive, like, throughout it.
Yeah, I listened to the interviews he did with Ariel, and I also listened to the interview he did with Luke Thomas. And I took more out of the interview with Luke Thomas than I did Ariel Helwani. It's no, I'm not trying to take any jabs at Ariel. I thought that I learned more because I thought Luke did really well, because in both interviews, Fabia is on the defensive, like very clear. He hates Joe Rogan. That's very evident about it. You know, but I thought that, you know, Ariel at times kind of interject himself to try basically saying, look, dude, I'm not here to have an argument with you. If you want to have an argument, go somewhere else type thing. And he basically kept saying, I'm on your side. I'm on your side. Or Luke just let him talk. And I'm just, you know, part of my thoughts is just kind of, I listen to those interviews and I'm like, it raises my point of what I said last week, Daniel. Where are the people close to Diego Sanchez in the fight community? Because you walk away from the interview and you're just like, good Lord, someone's taking advantage of Diego Sanchez. Like, I went to schoolofawareness.com because he was clearly trying to promote his website as much as he was talking about Diego Sanchez. And I'm sitting there going, okay, for someone who's doing all the things he's doing for Diego, I don't, where is the backing of his knowledge of all these aspects? Like where did he go to school on nutrition, for instance?
Dude, he doesn't even know who Pat Miletich is. Okay. If he doesn't know who Pat Miletich is, how are you supposed to educate? I mean, I know it's not a history contest, but in order to get good at anything in this planet, you must have an appreciation and an understanding for whatever you are trying to get good at. And if you don't understand, and that means going back through the history and understanding things, and to blow off Pat Miletich shows that this dude's an insane person, because it's like he thinks he's good at something that he clearly is not good at. He's talking, because it's all this BS where he like talks about, oh, if you rewatch the tape, you look at all the movements he did. Like, bro, what are you talking about? Like this isn't like, this isn't Naruto, okay? You're not going to find some spiritual organism that's going to help a guy go undefeated, all right? Like these performances by Diego Sanchez are not earth-shattering or world-breaking. The only reason why we're talking about it is because you're the only one in his corner and we're listening to his corner audio, and it's negligent. This is a very dangerous sport, and in the most dangerous part of Diego Sanchez's career, the guy, the only guy who is guiding him is a snake oil salesman. And these people have been granting him interviews, have been really nice to him. They have not attacked him. But if they did attack him, it's easy to win the fight. Because he's not relying on facts. He's not relying on anything. He's relying on the victim mindset that he somehow figured it out. And he's some victim. When in fact, the only victim in this whole situation is Diego Sanchez.
See, and then he does these interviews. And I think he has learned the very tough lesson of don't piss off the UFC. And so people may have seen this article where it's from MMAJunkie.com, and the headline is Joshua Fabia warned the Nevada Athletic Commission prior to UFC 239 that Diego Sanchez might kill Michael Chiesa. Now, when this headline came out, I was like, oh my God, I've got to read this story. Now, for people who have not heard about this story, so this was written by John Morgan, where he says, according to three people who spoke to MMA Junkie, you know, they didn't want their names to be out there, because they were not authorized to publicly discuss the matters. Fabia's work with Diego Sanchez was brought to the attention of both the Nevada Athletic Commission, UFC officials, in the hours ahead of UFC 239, when Diego was going to be taking on Michael Chiesa. In a Nevada Athletic Commission inspector brings up the fact that Fabia was burning incense and asked him to stop. The substance ultimately was not shown to be, you know, it was just a peppermint extract. But Dale, this is where it gets even crazier. Fabia tells a commission official that he and Sanchez have been working on a choke so brutal that if he was able to apply it to his opponent, the bout would be waved off immediately so as to prevent Michael Chiesa from either death or paralysis. So, Daniel, here's my speculation on this story. In one of the interviews, I want to say it's in the interview with Ariel, where Joshua took a little jab at Sean Shelby. I'm not saying I know this for sure, but I'm going to guess here that the UFC said, okay, you want to talk bad about us? They fed this story. And John Morgan got it confirmed by the Violent Athletic Commission. That's my perspective. I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying that's how I take this story.
Dude. And the choke that he described, I think, was described as a stone cold stunner.
Yes.
Dude, this dude, Josh Rabia, when he goes home at night, he sleeps in a little race car bed because he's still a kid, man. I mean, he's playing a kid's game. This is an adult sport. Oh, I found this thing that's going to kill him, so you might want to wave the fight off. Like, bro, what reality are you living in? What are you talking about? You're teaching him the Stone Cold Stunner. What are you going to teach him next? The Rock Bottom? Bro, I have a subscription to the WWE Network. Is that all I need to train UFC fighters? Again, you're out here like trying to... Oh my gosh, he cited in one of these interviews like training Emil Meek or whatever, and Emil Meek, when asked about it, completely roasts the guy. This guy is hilarious, he's a joke, he's a clown, and I can't wait until he's gone from the sport, but Jesus, like, yeah, this dude is a clown, bro.
Here's the thing, you know there is cameras all over the PI. How has there not been leak footage of him chasing around dudes in the octagon with a knife?
Yeah, I know.
That's the part, like, you know, if you're Diego Sanchez and you see this, like man, I just, you know, I mean, I saw Cub Swanson. He responded to, I don't know if it was Ariel, the Josh Gross interview or Luke Thomas interview, or he just wrote con artist in responding to the person's tweet. And, you know, it you feel bad. And this is what I ultimately think, Daniel, is going to happen. The UFC is going to give Diego Sanchez the hardest goddamn fight in his next fight.
Yeah, I could see that, especially
watch him get like UFC. A top 10 opponent who is just a straight killer.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. I don't know if he'll get a top 10 guy, but, look, man, all I got to say is I saw that Oscar award-winning movie Parasite, and if they ever make a sequel, Parasite 2, I'm sure they could just talk about Josh Fabia, because that dude is a parasite.
Dude, it's just amazing. And look, and you know what? The sad thing is I found myself making sure I went out and listened to every one of the interviews he did because I didn't know what he was going to say next.
Yeah, man. He's a clown. He's a clown. And he took his circus on tour. It's just, I call a spade, and it's a ridiculous story, but I thought we had to dig into it a week after, because after we recorded, he did all these interviews, just continued to dig his grave in the sport.
Yeah, that was just simply amazing, but let's move on. Let's talk a little Justin Gaethje. You know, of course, we haven't seen Justin now for some time, and, you know, and obviously we talked about, you know, Dan Hooker, and he mentions Justin Gaethje as a potential opponent, and then, you know, yesterday I'm kind of, you know, out doing various things for the J-O-B, and I see Ali Abdelaziz's tweet, and this is in relation to, I didn't hear it, but obviously everyone's been talking about it. Monday, Ariel Helwani on his show mentioned that the UFC was looking at doing Justin Gaethje versus Conor McGregor. We'll get to that in a second. But this is the tweet from Ali Abdelaziz, who manages Justin Gaethje. Quote, "This rumor about Gaethje fighting Conor is absolutely false. He had the opportunity to fight him already instead of Cowboy, but he didn't. Justin is a number one contender, and like Khabib said, Conor needs to win 10 fights. In the end of the tweet. Daniel, I've been thinking about this over the last couple hours. Here's what I think may be going on. The UFC wants to do Conor versus Justin Gaethje probably, you know, June, July-ish. And Conor's on board, and they are basically trying to publicly get Justin Gaethje to take the fight. And here's my other thing. Justin Gaethje, if your manager is not trying to get you a Conor McGregor fight, you need a new manager, bro.
Uh-huh. If your manager is not trying to make you rich, you need a new manager. Is exactly it, man. It seems like BS because it's like, why would you not? Like, you are in this sport to be the best and to make a whole hell of a lot of life-changing money because you don't have a whole lot of time to grab onto the brass ring and make a living out of this. So when you have an opportunity for Red Panty Night, your manager better take that fight for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things. And I mean, look, and obviously the merits of getting a title shot, I don't believe those in the UFC. But, you know, if you look at it from Justin Gaethje's perspective, I think sitting back and waiting for a title shot is not the best plan. I think if I was Gaethje, I would have said, put me on that April card. Put me in a fight. You know, if the title fight happens, great. I'll win my fight. We'll move, you know, potentially, you know, get the winner of that fight. But, you know, he's sitting on the sideline and maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like Dana White recently said they've offered Justin Gaethje multiple fights and he's turned it down. Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else, but for some reason I thought I remember Dana White saying that in an interview. But if we're going to talk about the case for Justin Gaethje getting a title fight, you know, when you look at his last he's on a 3-fight winning streak, all wins by knockout against James Vick, Edson Barboza, and Donald Cerrone. Now, if you look at the current top 10 UFC lightweight rankings, which I know we probably shouldn't put much meaning into them, Edson Barboza, who we now know is at 145 pounds, he is currently the number 10 challenger in the rankings. Donald Cerrone is number 6. So, and you look at the fighters ahead of Justin Gaethje, Conor McGregor, Dustin Poirier, and of course, Tony Ferguson. To me, I love Justin Gaethje's fighting style. And look, I would love to see him against Khabib or Tony. I just think that sitting on the sidelines and making this play of I'm the number one contender, I deserve next title shot, I don't think is the smartest of moves.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I don't think the world revolves around Justin Gaethje. And if you want to hold out and wait for a championship opportunity, you can certainly do that. You can certainly do that if the division revolves around you. But for a guy who is 4-2 in his last 6 fights in the UFC, the world does not revolve around Justin Gaethje. As exciting of a fighter as he is, there are plenty of other potential opportunities for this lightweight championship. And even though he is in consideration for a title opportunity, if he sits and waits, I think he's going to wait for a very long time. And I do think he's in this business to fight. He's in this business to compete. And for him, I do think he's going to need another fight. And it might be against a guy like Dan Hooker, who's done a good job of calling out opponents and getting those fights.
Look, there, you know, one thing about this business and on the management side is fighters get poached from one manager to another. Everyone knows it goes on. It happens. I wouldn't be shocked. And I'm not looking. I am not saying that I think that this has happened. This is pure speculation on my part. But I could see another manager look at that Ali Abdelaziz tweet and go, contact Justin Gaethje. Go, hey, Justin, you do know the fight that you can make the most money is against Conor McGregor, right? I'll get you that fight if Ali won't get you that fight. Now, look, Ali, I feel like, tweets about Conor McGregor every day. You know, so, I mean, it's one of these things of, like, at the end of the day, a manager's job is to make their client the most money. And I don't know how having the mindset of Justin's going to sit on the side. Here's the other thing I truly believe will happen. Let's say Khabib gets through Tony in April. Okay. Saying that, let's knock on wood, that fight's going to happen in April. That I think at that point, the UFC will tell Khabib, your next fight is against Conor McGregor. Are you going to take it or not? Because at the end of the day, this is about the UFC making the most money. This is about how do they add to that bottom line to make all their ownership happy of this. And to me, it's a fight that's going to happen. I mean, I don't care what Ali Abdelaziz says about this. The UFC is going to at some point put an ultimatum in Khabib. And if Khabib won't take the fight, I think you're going to get that relationship is going to get awful. But the fact is, there's not a fight that the UFC can make that can bring the type of attention to the UFC financially that the rematch between Khabib and Conor can do.
Yeah, I think for the UFC, that is the focus. And for the most part, the UFC is in the business to make the most money. And those fights happen because those people involved want to make a whole lot of money. And this is an instance where, to me, I just feel as though it is posturing from Khabib's camp to make this point so they can try and get the most money out of them. I really feel like they kind of have that Galaxy Brand approach where it's like, oh, we're going to act like, you know, we care about these things when really we're just trying to create leverage to get the most money, because things that make money in this sport are inevitable.
Here's one thing I wonder, Daniel, and I don't know the answer to this question. So, I mean, we both know there is not a bigger star in the sport than Conor McGregor, and there's no one even close to second. If I walk into a sports bar on Friday night, and let's just say there's 20 seats at the bar, they're all filled up, all with dudes between the ages of 25 to 50. How many of them could pick Khabib Nurmagomedov out of the lineup?
Well, if you told him his name was Khabib Nurmagomedov, they probably would. But if he said there's a famous UFC fighter here, you wouldn't be able to do it. Yeah, I mean, Khabib's popular, but he's probably like 4 or 5 out of 10 if you're talking about 10 guys.
Yeah, I mean, look, when I think of pound for pound, you know, in terms of all of MMA, you know, I still look at Demetrius Johnson, but I think he probably, you know, Khabib would probably be the number one that you would look at. I mean, just the way he just dominates guy. But it's just one of those things. I was talking to somebody the other day, and we were talking about star power in MMA and who has star power. And, you know, and of course, obviously we talk about Conor, you know, I mean, look, literally you could have Conor going up against a warm body and 200 people are going to show up in your bar to watch the fight. But with Khabib Nurmagomedov, like, I mean, look, I can't wait for him and Tony. God, hopefully that fight happens in April. But it's one of these things where I sit there and go, I wonder in terms of, especially here in the United States, of how big of a star is Khabib in terms of mainstream sports?
I don't know. I think he's in terms of mainstream sports fans, I really don't think he's a huge star currently. I think his star is certainly growing, but I don't look at him as he's close to a Conor level. I think you get your casual sports fans, a pocket of them will know who he is, but he's definitely on that climb. And for him, I think to get higher and higher, it is continuing to be a part of the spotlight. Get another Conor fight, get another Conor victory, really put him away. I think that's how that star begins to escalate. Because looking at Nurmagomedov thus far in his career, I think he's only been in one fight where it felt like he was truly exposed to that casual fan.
Yeah, I mean, outside of the Conor fight, he hasn't really had that opportunity. I mean, look, and maybe he will be a big star. I mean, I think it'll be very interesting if that fight does ultimately happen April 18th, is, you know, it'd be interesting to kind of go out and just see how many fans are sitting at a sports bar watching that event. But, you know, Daniel, let's move on to some fights that are happening on this weekend. UFC Norfolk, of course, headlined by the vacant flyweight title fight between Joseph Benavidez and Davison Figueiredo. And, you know, there's some things that happen in this sport that necessarily don't see coming. And it was yesterday I saw that Joseph and his wife, Megan O'Leary, appeared on Kelly and Ryan. I mean, look, outside of, you know, say, a Conor McGregor or Jon Jones, I don't see many male fighters being booked for Kelly and Ryan. So kudos, whether that was the UFC or somebody else, to get, you know, get some notoriety on there. But, you know, this card, I think, is a little bit like last week's card in a way of, you know, you got a main event that, you know, is definitely a fight that you want to see. And then you've got some fights on the card that you're like, okay, I like that fight. I'm interested to see that fighter, but it there's not like those three or four fights that you're just like, oh my God, I have to be at home on Saturday night.
Yeah. This is a really like solid undercard for your hardcore mixed martial arts fan. Like, you will get hyped to watch Alon Cruz fight Spike Carlisle in the featherweight division. That's a nice little fight. Watching Sergey Spivak come in and compete against Marcin Tybura, I'm excited. To me, the top-tier fight on the ESPN Plus prelims, in my humble opinion, is the middleweight contest between Brandon Allen and Tom Breese. Mm-hmm. I think both those guys are good at middleweight. It's nice to see a guy we've seen compete in Bellator, Steve Garcia, get an opportunity here against Luis Pena. To me, on that main card, what sticks out? All right, Grant Dawson, Derek Minner sticks out largely due to Grant Dawson. He is roughly a 420 favorite. So the thought is he's going to go out there and put away Minner. Also on that main card, you're like, okay, I'm down with the Magomed Ankalaev. This is a guy who looked really good in his last fight. He's the promising light heavyweight. Also, Megan Anderson versus Norma Dumont Viana. Anderson is the slight favorite, but we have a fighter in Viana who is 4-0, undefeated, and certainly she could have a star-making performance against Megan Anderson, and she could really flip the table in this women's featherweight division if she comes out and passes with flying colors. But the primary focus is on the main event, and it's not just the main event fight. It's the one fighter in particular, because what we get here is an opportunity for Joseph Benavidez to finally call himself UFC flyweight champion. He has been one of those guys who's been in that number two spot in this weight class forever. And to me, the story is simple. Will he be able to get past one tough opponent in Davison Figueiredo to kind of have that storybook highlight in his career?
I'm interested in Alon Cruz because Alon Cruz is from my hometown of Tampa. Had him in studio a couple of weeks ago. Look, we're supposed to be straight down the middle, have no bias. Straight up, I'm going to have a lot of bias in that fight. I'm going to be rooting for Alon Cruz to go out there and win. You know, Sean Bray's another guy interested me. TJ Brown, I had a chat with him 2 weeks ago. That's up on the MMA Report YouTube channel. And one of the things that really stuck out to me, what he said to me was, he goes, I'm going in there to take Jordan's soul. And I go, whoa, okay, hold on. What do you mean by this? And he basically saying is just basically, I'm going to make him quit. Essentially, that's what he's saying. But I do like that Brandon Allen versus Tom Breese fight. You know, another fight that does intrigue me, Daniel, is this Luis Pena, Steve Garcia fight. Steve Garcia is a guy that I got to meet, man, Jesus, 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe longer than that. And I was surprised when he got this fight because remember, he was on the Contender Series as a 35er, missed weight, fought in LFA at 45, missed weight, now did get the wins in those fights. And now he's got this fight at 155 pounds. So I was kind of surprised to see he got in on this opportunity. But look, it is all about that main event. And you know, I think one of the questions about this main event is arguably one of the greatest pound-for-pound fighters could not get people excited for men's 125 pounds. Is there anything that can be done in North America to get people excited about flyweights?
Certainly, the answer is let's look at the blueprint, and it's all about finding individual fighters who are superstars. I mean, that's the way we revive weight classes, and certainly Benavidez isn't going to be that. But when I look at this fight card, it's not only an indictment on the flyweight division, an inflection point, which again, this is a weight class that we thought wasn't going to exist. But it's also the women's featherweight division, another division that is really always, you know, wouldn't be surprised if we read a headline that it's shut down for good, where this main card to me is all about the future of the flyweight and the women's featherweight division. We have two women's featherweight fights in Felicia Spencer versus Zara Dos Santos in Megan Anderson versus Norma Viana that is going to look to create potential title challengers. And then we have the flyweight championship fight, which is going to start a new era for the flyweight division. Both these weight classes are very much in a rough spot. I think the best champion going forward for the flyweight division would be Joseph Benavidez. I think this would be a great story. But if we're looking at what can make this division pop, it's going to be about finding a good story to tell in terms of a challenger for Joseph Benavidez. It is the stars that bring weight classes to the top.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I think for longtime MMA fans, I think we're all rooting for Joseph Benavidez.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
I don't think it's intentional. It's just because we have seen Joe grow up as a fighter through the WEC and UFC, and you know how close he came to being a 125 pound champion. That could not happen. Now he's in this one. Is it wrong of me to say Davison Figueiredo is going to knock him out?
Look, we've seen Benavidez prone to knockouts a couple times. Johnson knocked him out. I think the one knockout he had, and there's been a couple times where he got rocked. But if I don't, that's not my pick though. I mean, I just think Benavidez is clicking on all cylinders, and usually when he's not taking on Dom Cruz for the WC bantamweight title or DJ for a couple of flyweight opportunities, he's getting victories. So I don't know, man. I mean, the thing is, you do get worried for Benavidez that maybe this title opportunity came a little too late in his career, but he's just looked amazing, especially his performance against Juicy Formiga, where I think he's going to win. But Figueiredo certainly poses a problem. I mean, who are you leaning towards in this fight?
Man, my gut wants to say Benavidez. My brain just says I think Davison Figueiredo would be too much for him.
Wow. That would be quite a sad footnote in Benavidez's career here. To get an opportunity against a guy where, you know, the betting odds think he's a slight favorite, and to lose to Figueiredo. But, I mean, Figueiredo is not someone to mess with, man. He looked great against Tim Elliott in Tampa. And he's basically passed every test except for that loss to Formiga. And, yeah, he's pretty damn good at 17-1.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see how the fight goes. I'll probably be watching on Saturday night. I'll be looking forward to seeing that fight. And I mean, look, as a long time consumer of combat sports, I would love to see Joseph Benavidez get the win. But I think ultimately the question is kind of what's this? You know, you still kind of wonder about, you know, the long term future of 125 pounds in the UFC. But of course, that'll be coming up on Saturday on ESPN Plus. But Daniel, let's wrap up this show by talking about some notable fight bookings. The UFC made it official. I want to say it was Monday. That Henry Cejudo will defend the UFC bantamweight title against Jose Aldo in the main event of UFC 250 on May the 9th. Let me ask you this question. Upset with the booking? Because I'm indifferent.
I actually am. Because I just feel as though Aldo doesn't deserve a title opportunity coming off this loss. Even though I think he certainly deserves. Like, he deserved the victory over Marlon Moraes. Like, I scored it for Jose Aldo. I'm upset with the booking because I just don't think he deserves this shot against Cejudo, which is why I'm upset, even though I understand why the UFC made it, because the Aldo-Cejudo fight is maybe a lot more marketable than other things he could do.
Yeah, I'm just like indifferent. I gotta understand why the UFC is making it in a way. I understand why Henry Cejudo, wants this fight. I might blow your mind right now, Daniel.
I'm ready.
Do you understand that Henry Cejudo and Jose Aldo are the same age?
That's crazy to me. They are both. Wow.
They are both 33 years old.
That's amazing. That's a hell of a stat, which is, yeah, you think. Look, here's the thing. When Henry Cejudo debuted in this sport as a professional, Jose Aldo had already defended his UFC featherweight championship like 3 or 4 times.
It's amazing.
That's crazy. I mean, that's what happens when you go and you compete in the Olympics for a while, but that's one hell of a system. I can't believe Aldo's only 33, to be honest with you. I mean, seriously, think about it. This dude is 33, and he first got on our radars, I feel like, when he had the flying knee knockout of Cub Swanson 11 years ago, June 2009. Ugh, it makes no sense.
I saw that stat. I'm like, oh, my God. That is, I mean, because I think we always kind of had that with Jose Aldo. Like, wow, he's only 33 years old, really? Just because he's been around for so long, you just expect he's going to be older. I mean, look, it'll be interesting if Cejudo kind of keeps up the whole Triple C moniker once he gets down to, I want to say this fight's in Rio, is because, I mean, look, he's going to get a lot of chance. And, I expect him to, to retain his title. But I think the interesting part of that fight is will Jose Aldo implement the leg kicks? We really haven't seen it in the fight. The other fight booking to announce, UFC 251, Valentina Shevchenko taking on Jojo Calderwood. Of course, this will be in Australia. It's expected to be the main event. It'll be Alexander Volkanovski versus Max Holloway. I feel bad for Jojo.
Yeah, me too, man. I feel bad for anyone matched up against Shevchenko.
How does she win that fight?
I don't know, man.
I mean, look, I know crazy upsets in MMA do happen, but since this fight has been announced, I keep thinking, I'm going, how is she going to win the fight? She's not going to outstrike her. So she's got to get the fight to the ground. And we've seen Shevchenko be able to stop that. I just look at that and say, man, I feel like that's going to be a very bad evening, early afternoon in Australia for Jojo.
Yeah. And for Calderwood, it's just looking at her last couple performances, she hasn't really been amazing against Andrea Lee and her loss to Chikagian and Ariana Lipsky. So this just seems like another successful title defense for Shevchenko in my book.
Yeah. I mean, I think you completely expect that. You know, in the Volkanovski Holloway fight, I actually think it's pretty much kind of the right fight to make.
Yeah, my thought was after that fight, let's do a rematch, and I'm glad we could do it. And it's going to be a tough fight for Volkanovski, man. I think to get a champion on a rematch, he's going to make some championship adjustments.
Oh, no, I'm totally with you. He's going to make those adjustments. And, you know, I think it's, you know, and obviously the Korean Zombie having the surgery that he had, I want to say they need to get done. I mean, it definitely makes all the sense in the world, but yeah. So, you know, we've got the UFC coming up this weekend. Look forward to, seeing that flyweight title fight. You know, just personally mentioned to see Alon Cruz just being a Tampa based fighter. So, looking forward to that. Of course, MMA Report podcast comes out every Wednesday on radioinfluence.com. Also available on all the favorite podcasting platforms. Anything else you want to discuss before we get out of here, Daniel?
Not much, man. I think we nailed it. Can't wait to talk about the fights that happen this weekend, next week, and preview and look ahead to what we got cooking in the oven.
Look, I can't wait to see another IG video from you of you just out there in center field by yourself working a camera.
Yeah, man. Baseball season. You got a buzzer? I don't have no buzzer. I will not admit nothing, but it's baseball season, and you know, not just for college baseball, but I'm looking forward to the Major League Baseball season. We got some storylines with the Houston Astros making things interesting.
Did you see they put an over-under number out on how many times they're going to get hit by a pitch?
I'll take the under on that one.
I think it was like 86 is the number.
Wow. I wonder what the usual average is for a team. But I would take the under because, dude, the first time it happens and it's like intentional, dude, that person's getting suspended. I mean, yeah, Rob Manfred is not going to – I mean, I don't know if Rob Manfred will make the whole MLB season, but he's not going to, you know.
Well, remember, they're just playing for a piece of metal.
Yeah, I know. That was one of the worst quotes he could have done. That was like, damn, bonehead move right there.
Oh, Jesus. I mean, like, how do you say that?
Literally, how do you say that for like the whole, like, sports leagues are just like, let's compete for this. And he devalues like the thing that gives the league value. It's insane for a commissioner to do that. Like, their one job is to be beholden to the owners and preserve the value of the game. And he called the World Series trophy just a piece of metal.
What's it, game day? You had one job?
Yeah, one job he failed. Big time.
Oh, man. That when I saw that quote after the fact, I was like, are you kidding me? Did he seriously say that?
Yeah, that's when I was like, dude, this dude may have like put his job in danger with that quote. Like everything,
I feel like that's something Dana White would say.
Yeah, except for I don't think he would say that about his UFC championship.
Hey, you're just fighting for a piece of metal.
Yeah, I don't think he would freaking say that because he's a promoter. He gets what promoting's all about.
Yeah. By the way, did you watch the pay per view on Saturday night? The boxing.
Oh, big time, yeah. It was. It felt like everyone was watching it, so I made sure to go out there and watch it myself. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I went over to a buddy's house. You know, the interesting thing is because we watch so many fights, it's always kind of interesting. And look, I don't watch a ton of live boxing. I'm not going to like pretend that I do. But it is one of those things where we're sitting on my buddy's couch, and one of the guys just goes, are these guys ever going to walk to the ring or what?
Mm-hmm. boxing takes forever, man, to get things started. I mean, these fights happen late. But
dude,
yeah.
How strong were the dude? Like the first, the throne that Fury came on, like, first of all, I'm thinking that thing had to be on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was not on wheels, how strong are those dudes?
I know. Fury weighed in like plus 270. I mean, he was packing something there, man. And I feel bad for those dudes for sure. I hope they got a nice payday. But,
dude, I think that's about $28 million guaranteed for each guy.
Oof. That's awesome.
MMA that's Fighters, awesome. Take note. Take note.
Yeah, exactly.
Take note of that New York Post article that says the UFC owners just got dividends. What did that say? I think Tom Brady got like $145,000 or something.
Jesus, he doesn't need it. But here we are. And it's like,
Every time I see one of those stories, I go, will UFC fighters finally go, oh, crap, we're only getting like 16% of the revenues.
Which is insane when you look at like all these CBA arguments and they talk about the revenues that some of these athletes are getting.
I'm at this point, like I feel like the media has done this battle for MMA fighters for so many years. I feel like as the media, and I'm not just trying, I can only talk to myself, but I feel like as the media, we've just gotten to this point of like, we're tired of fighting for the fighters because they're just not going to do anything for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that wrong? Is that a wrong take for me to have?
Well, I get it because we've just been pounding the pavement saying the same thing over and over again, and there isn't a difference.
Yeah, I know. Like, it's just like I saw a New York Post article, and I'm like, okay, we've seen these before.
Yeah.
We've seen the antitrust lawsuit, and I'm like, nothing's changed.
Mm-hmm. Nothing has changed at all. And it's just so many of the different problems we have in the sport. It's just consistently there.
Yeah. But yeah, so we'll see if anything happens with that, but I highly doubt it. But do appreciate everyone that takes time out of their day to download this podcast. If you haven't left a rating, if you listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, you haven't left us a rating, I really would appreciate if you would leave us a rating. That really does help myself and Daniel out. Of course, be sure to check out all my video interviews up on themmareport.com. Also, coming up tomorrow, myself and Pete Rogers Jr. will have a DFS show for UFC Norfolk. We'll have a little announcement coming here very soon about the DFS show. Very cool announcement that we're very excited about to be making here. So that is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast, which comes out every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
I'm Jerry Pitot, CEO of Radio Influence. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on any of our programming, or if you have some show ideas you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you take time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means more than you could ever know. Without you, the listener, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to all of our programming. You can find all of Radio Influence's programming on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, RadioInfluence.com.